From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. The so-called war on drugs has failed. America's drug crisis is worse than ever, even though billions of dollars have been spent to fix it. On today's Fresh Air, we look at some alternative solutions to the drug crisis with Mathea Falco, advisor to President Clinton during the campaign, and with sociologist Elliot Curry. Both have books about drugs and drug policy in America. Also, we remember tennis star Arthur Ashe with a 1989 interview. He died over the weekend of complications from the AIDS virus. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers the 1973 year in rock music and is surprised at what he found. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The special prosecutor in the Iran-Contra investigation told Congress today that President Bush's pardon of Caspar Weinberger prevented new evidence about the case from reaching the public. Lawrence Walsh said that Ronald Reagan's chief of staff and secretary of state would have testified that his administration misstated facts to protect the president from impeachment. In an interim report to Congress, Walsh said that former White House Chief of Staff Donald Regan and former Secretary of State George Shultz were prepared to testify at the Weinberger trial. Walsh said that both men would have testified that President Reagan knew about the arms for hostages deal and that administration officials lied to conceal that fact. French President François Mitterrand said in an interview today that the arms embargo against the former Yugoslav republics is full of holes. He said that France doesn't want Bosnia to become the victim of a measure that's meant to protect it. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
President Mitterrand said France is abiding by the embargo, but he said it would be ridiculous if it prevented the Muslims from buying arms while enabling the Serbs to do so. Mitterrand made these comments in an interview with the respected daily Le Monde. He said France supports the peace plan that's being considered by the warring Yugoslav factions, but he said if the plan is discarded, France would continue to support the principle of one Bosnian state with flexible institutions. Mitterrand said France would not engage in any solitary military operations in the former Yugoslavia, adding that France would apply all United Nations Security Council resolutions. Today, Foreign Minister Roland Dumas proposed the constitution of a UN court to judge war crimes in former Yugoslavia. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Afghan rebels shelled and rocketed Kabul today in the worst day of fighting since August. Susie Price reports for the BBC.
Four rockets landed in the center of town near the Jamhuriyat Hospital in the afternoon, killing at least 10 people and wounding another 20. A doctor working for Médecins Sans Frontières, Marc Bio, said their main problem was coping with a sudden influx of badly injured patients from such attacks. Much of the shelling over the past weeks was apparently aimed at military targets, but now it seems the rockets are falling randomly in the city. Residents have given up trying to find a safe place within Kabul and are loading up buses and vans with possessions to head eastwards. In the Mikrorayon estate, one man stared wistfully at yet another truck driving away. The only people left in Kabul, he said, are the ones who can't afford to escape.
Susie Price reporting for the BBC. Stock prices closed slightly lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 5 points to close at 3,437. This is NPR. President Clinton announced changes today that he said will address White House environmental policy in a more effective way. The president abolished the Advisory Council on Environmental Quality and replaced it with the policy-making White House Office on Environmental Policy. The White House office will be headed by Kathleen McGinty, a 29-year-old lawyer who served as the top environmental policy advisor to Vice President Gore. General Motors says it's suing NBC, charging that the network aired a deceptive report on an alleged design flaw in millions of GM pickup trucks. Don Gagne reports.
Last November, the NBC program Dateline aired footage of a test crash in which a GM pickup truck burst into flames after being broadsided by another vehicle. The report said full-size pickups built by GM are prone to burst into flames because the gas tanks are mounted outside the vehicle's steel frame rails. At a news conference in Detroit today, GM presented evidence to show that the fire in the report was caused not by the crash, but by small ignition devices mounted on the vehicle. Harry Pierce is GM's attorney.
This is not, I repeat, a public relations offensive. This is nothing more than a search for truth.
NBC says it stands by its story. Just last week, a jury found GM negligent for selling dangerous pickup trucks and ordered the company to pay an Atlanta couple $105 million. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Police in Los Angeles say that a disgruntled patient is holding at least two hostages at the Los Angeles County Hospital after shooting and wounding three doctors. A hospital spokesman said the patient entered the emergency room and opened fire on a group of doctors sitting at a desk near the door. Two of the doctors wounded are said to be in stable condition, and a third remains in critical condition. Police say the gunman is now barricaded in an isolated section of the hospital's emergency room. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The number of heavy drug abusers in this country is estimated at 5.5 billion and rising. My guest, Mathea Falco, is trying to figure out what to do about that. She's a drug policy analyst who was an advisor to Bill Clinton during his presidential campaign. She also served as Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics Matters under President Jimmy Carter. She's the author of a new book about drug programs that work, The Making of a Drug-Free America. Falco thinks we need to take a new look at our national drug policy.
Since 1981, we have spent more than $100 billion tax dollars trying to control the supply of drugs, trying to reduce the availability of heroin and cocaine coming into the country. And in fact, now those drugs are more available at cheaper prices than ever before. So I think a lot of people look around and see a lot of drug addiction, increasing drug crime, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars being spent, and yet where's the progress? So no wonder they feel discouraged.
Well, what is the good news about drugs?
Well, the good news is that in the past decade, there has been a substantial amount of research that shows we really can reduce the demand for drugs, and that if we begin to focus on prevention, education, treatment, community organization, community policing, efforts right here at home, in our own towns, in our own homes and schools, we really can make an impact both on drug abuse and drug crime.
What would you say then has been wrong with the policy which the Clinton-Gore administration has inherited from the Bush administration, which does focus on interdiction and on the punishment of drug dealers? Should any of that policy be maintained to deal with the problems of the 90s?
Marty, I think we have to take a very hard look at drug policies. Right now, in a $13 billion national drug budget, we are spending almost as much on foreign drug eradication and interdiction programs as on all prevention, education, and treatment combined. That gives you a sense of where the priorities are. When Ronald Reagan came into office in 1981, he immediately put 80% of federal drug dollars into trying to cut off the supplies, and only 20% into prevention and treatment. This resulted in substantial cuts in treatment and prevention, which we're still living with today. For example, fewer than 20% of the nation's drug addicts can get treatment unless they can afford to pay for it. We all see the consequences of that in terms of street crime, homelessness, drug addicts using the public emergency rooms and hospitals because there are no treatment programs. We're all paying for this problem in many, many ways.
Let's talk a little bit about drug treatment programs, and they seem to have had a more have had fairly checkered results. If you look at some statistics, it shows that drug treatment is not always a solution to a drug problem. What are some of the hallmarks of effective drug treatment programs?
The best programs, Marty, are rigorous, intensive, and they tend to last at least a year, whether that's in the direct participation in the program or through some follow-on activity. The one unifying factor about success in drug treatment is that length of time in treatment is directly related to success. And they have found that for those people who can stick with drug treatment for a year or longer, the success rate is 3 out of 4, which is really very impressive.
many people drop in and drop out of drug treatment programs. Does that mean that the programs are a failure?
Oh, not at all. In fact, we have to start thinking of the treatment process as one which will inevitably involve several efforts before success. I mean, let's again talk about cigarette smoking. The average successful quitter, the person who finally walks away from cigarettes, has relapsed 4 times. That is, gone back to smoking after 4 quitting attempts before finally giving up. But yet we don't think of that as hopeless. I mean, people don't say, "Oh, well, you can't ever give up smoking because looks, you know, the average quitting, you know, has to go through 4 series." But we've tended, for historical reasons, to think about drug abuse treatment very differently. We tend to think about it as something a little bit like driving your car to the shop and getting a new carburetor put in. If it doesn't work, you know, you drive the car to the shop and you leave it there for a 28-day rehab or whatever, and you drive it out, and if you have any problems at all, then the whole thing is a failure. Well, in fact, it's very tough to change behavior in a 28-day period. What you're talking about is getting through the chemical addiction. But much more important is you're talking about reconnecting to life and finding a way to construct a meaningful life pattern that doesn't rely on alcohol and drugs to numb the individual.
One of the hallmarks of drug addiction is that treatment rarely works or is very difficult unless the addict himself or herself wants the help. Have you found that as you look at programs at work that that's been an important ingredient?
Well, that certainly is the received wisdom, Marty, that, you know, you can't get well until you're ready to get well. I mean, the notion that you have to overcome denial. And I think that's all true. But what we have also discovered in the last few years is there are a lot of different kinds of incentives that can push people into getting into treatment and staying there. For example, in the workplace, many large companies now require drug testing. And if you test positive, then you're required to get treatment. And if you can't stick with treatment, or if you come back out of treatment and you continue to test positive, your job is often in jeopardy. Now, what's happened in many cases is that those people who know that their jobs are at stake and they can get good treatment are then able actually to give up drugs and alcohol.
Let's talk about an addict. Let's say they want to get treatment. They've had some problems with the law. They haven't been incarcerated quite yet. What's the chance that an addict on the streets of New York or Washington or Philadelphia can get treatment?
Terrible. It's truly heartbreaking, especially in the largest cities. Here in New York, for example, there are an estimated 250,000 heroin addicts and probably another 300,000 cocaine addicts. And there are only 40,000 drug treatment slots in New York City. And 30,000 of that 40,000 are dedicated to methadone, which means that only heroin addicts who want to get onto methadone can use them. So it gives you a little sense of how squeezed the situation is. The other point is that we need to make treatment more user-friendly. I mean, that is, for example, mothers who are addicts who have young children. They're often single parents. We'll have to give those children into foster care before they can go into treatment. Well, many women are unwilling to do that, no matter how disrupted their lives are, because they're afraid they'll never get their kids back, and that's not an unrealistic fear. There are very few programs still for pregnant addicts. We need to begin to understand that if we are going to have an impact on drug addiction, we have to make treatment readily available. That means almost in the day that I decide I can't stand my life anymore, I need to get treatment, that day I should be into a treatment program. And if I have a 2-year-old kid that I'm responsible for, there should be some way of dealing with that child care requirement instantly. Otherwise, you know, the reason for all this, I mean, I'd like to think it's purely humanitarian, but the real truth is practical. We are now, Dick Darman, who was President Bush's head of the Office of Management and Budget, told Congress last year that drug abuse is now costing us $300 billion a year. In lost productivity, accidents, health care claims, drug crime, you know, 300,000 drug-affected babies born every year. The AIDS virus is being transmitted most rapidly in this country through drug abuse. I mean, the costs go on and on. Most of your listeners probably could recite another 15. But the point is that we aren't really addressing it in a way that's going to improve any of these problems.
The remedies you suggest are really all focused at the local level, whether it's in neighborhoods, whether it's in schools, whether it's in businesses. What role do you think then the federal government plays in drug policy?
Leadership. I mean, that is the single most important thing the federal government should be doing. They should be providing a clear message about what we know, about what works and what doesn't. It is because of the federal role that for the last 12 years, we've put more than three quarters of our resources into trying to reduce supplies. That's why right now schools are basically trying to pick out prevention curricula where they have no guidance at all about which ones have been tested, which ones work better, which, you know, I mean, school administrators are doing their best out there, but by golly, they don't have a consumer's union report which tells them what they should be buying. And the Department of Education in the past has refused to take a position on any of these. They've said it's a free market choice. Well, the free market doesn't work unless you have really readily accessible, adequate information.
We don't have, or nor do we aspire to, an alcohol-free America. What makes you think we can have a drug-free America?
Well, I have to confess that that was the publisher's title, not mine. But I do think we can make an enormous dent in the present problem. Drug addiction is now worse than it's ever been in our history. And we have less treatment, less resource to deal with it. I think that we should give this a real try. We have enough flexibility within our current laws to change our focus, to understand that supply control, law enforcement cannot be the sole response. You see, that's been the big problem in the last 12 years, is that the policy has become so polarized. Richard Nixon, back in the 60s, who really talked tough against drugs, in fact put two-thirds of the federal drug budget into treatment. And in those days, treatment was available on demand. I mean, it's only been, so I'm suggesting that it's not a partisan issue. It's just in the last 12 years that the policy has become so extraordinarily focused on one side of the equation. And the costs have been terrible.
Well, I thank you, Mathia Falco, for joining us today on Fresh Air. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Marty. I enjoyed it.
Mathia Falco is the author of The Making of a Drug-Free America. We'll continue our discussion of drug policy with sociologist Elliot Curry after a short break. This is Fresh Air. While prevention and treatment programs are one approach to drug abuse, sociologist Elliot Curry argues that we have to go a lot farther. Like Falco, he says that law enforcement has its limitations and has not deterred the bulk of illegal drug activity. Drugs, he says, are inextricably linked to the culture of poverty, which breeds hopelessness. Curry is the author of the new book, Reckoning: Drugs, the Cities, and the American Future. While Curry acknowledges that drugs cross class lines, he says it's not destroying the middle class the way it has taken its toll on the urban poor. I asked him why the drug problem has gotten worse.
I think the primary reason has to do with the radically deteriorating conditions for people who are living in the inner cities. We, I think, don't adequately realize what a disastrous impact the policies of the last 10 or 12 years in particular have had upon low-income people in the United States. And I should say that when I talk about cities, I'm being a little bit euphemistic, because the same processes have happened in small towns, they've happened in rural areas. But what you have seen, I think, is a really radical diminishing of the life chances of people in the lower third of the income scale in American society in a variety of ways: declining opportunities for good work at decent wages, rising levels of poverty, greater concentration of people in communities where other poor people live and no one else lives, radically diminished public services, radically diminished health care, the destruction of low-income housing, the inability to find a place to live. All of these things put together have created a situation that's really unprecedented for people at the bottom of the scale in the United States. And that really is the breeding ground for the drug problem.
You write that there have been a number of studies to show that a certain number of addicts recover without any kind of formal treatment. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily have to go through a 12-step program to get better. Does anyone know what are the conditions that make somebody get better, that make them give up their drug habit?
I think we do know a lot about that. Of course, we could obviously know more than we do, but I think the brunt of the evidence would go something like this. It would say that basically what makes people get better, whether or not they're in a formal treatment program, is what I would call having a stake in a drug-free life, which means that you have the possibility of a stable family life, that you have the possibility of decent work that helps to structure your life and give you a good reason for being clean and sober. And when you put both of those things together, work and family, I think they're two of the most important necessities for getting off of drugs. And that, again, it applies to whether you're in a treatment program or you're trying to kick drugs outside of a treatment program.
But you can't just build healthy families. I mean, that takes generations to create a healthy family.
Well, certainly you're right. I mean, creating healthy families is not something that we can do by snapping our fingers and decreeing it to be so. On the other hand, our hands are not tied. We know a lot, I think, about the conditions that make for healthy families. In my book, for example, I talk about certain kinds of family policies that I think would help a great deal along this line, including doing something about our fragmented and totally inadequate child care system in the United States, for example.
Well,
I talk about parental leave policies, about family support programs, and a number of things that I think we have excellent evidence work very well and would really help families.
So you're talking about then creating a more equitable child care system, family leave policies that allow someone to take care of family problems without having to pay the price at work, programs like
mm-hmm.
this?
Yes. And I think child care is especially important. You know, it's kind of funny. I often get people look at me somewhat askance when I say that a better child care system would be an important step in dealing with our country's drug problem. But it makes perfect sense. People who are stressed out, as families so often are, as parents so often are, by the conflicting demands of family and work, people who have no place to put their kids so they can't even join the labor force to get a job, and so they can't improve their incomes or have the possibility of a decent life in the future, are people who are ripe for drug abuse. So helping those people to deal with their needs for child care, with their needs for flex time between work and family. These things are enormously important.
What kind of a job policy do you think would be effective for helping many of the people in the inner city who are at risk for drug use or drug dealing? And how could they be trained to be productive parts of society and also feel that they have a future and a stake in the future?
Well, you've put your finger on what I think is absolutely the central and the most and the toughest part of the whole problem, at least as affects the problem of drug abuse in the inner city. I think what we're going to have to do is really radically revise the way we think about jobs in America. It's not going to be enough simply to create a few training programs for disadvantaged people in the inner city. We're going to have to do some serious efforts at job creation because of what's been going on in our economy. Our economy is shedding good jobs right and left. You can pick up the newspaper virtually every day and read of yet more layoffs, of yet more people without decent wages and decent benefits. This is a very critical structural transformation in our economy. And among other things, what it's going to do, what it has done already, is it has enormously increase the vulnerability to drug abuse. So I think we're going to have to deal with that directly. It's going to mean policies to try to upgrade jobs in the private sector of the economy, and equally importantly, I think, we're going to have to bite the bullet on public job creation. We're going to have to recognize that our private economy may simply be unable to provide a sufficient number of good jobs of the kind that really provide someone with a stake in their society. So we're going to have to make those jobs. And there's obviously no shortage of work that needs to be done.
One of the things that you suggest is to look at this issue of infrastructure, the fact that we need more roads, we need better transportation, public transportation. And you suggest really linking that with some kind of job corps or job creation, job building program. Describe how that would work.
Well, I think we've come to an agreement in the last couple of years, especially in, across a wide chunk of the political spectrum in this country, that we do need to put a great deal more resources into rebuilding and especially maintaining the infrastructure, particularly if we think about that term broadly, not just to include roads and airports and railroads, but also the social infrastructure, the schools, the healthcare clinics, and a number of other things which we've sadly neglected for a generation. I think that the great thing about working on the infrastructure is that we can provide jobs at the same time that we are literally rebuilding our communities from the ground up. It's a wonderful opportunity to plug into, for example, a youth employment program so that we can be training some disadvantaged kids for good jobs of the kind that that go into infrastructure work, construction jobs, maintenance jobs, and a whole range of things which are good, which are well-paying, which are challenging, and which can provide a stake in the future for people who now don't have it. It's a largely untapped area. We have, you know, there are all kinds of very fancy mathematical calculations of just how many jobs we can create per $1 billion of investment in the infrastructure. And it's all very compelling. I think this is a place where we could really do a lot of good and kill several birds with one stone.
The American Bar Association had talked about the fact that so much is being spent, at least in the criminal justice system, so much is being spent on drug offenses. And do you see organizations like this beginning to see the limits of the old way of dealing with drugs and the people, you think the people are really wanting to try some new ways of dealing with drugs?
I think so. I think that things are turning. I think that they're changing. And I think in part it is because of the enormous fiscal costs of what we've been doing so far. I think we had this notion that we could somehow just put people behind bars in ever-increasing numbers, and then the problem would go away, and it would be, in some sense, costless. We expected that it would have much more of an impact than it, in fact, did. Well, now we're seeing the problems with that kind of reasoning. We have spent billions upon billions of dollars to the point where our expenditures on corrections, for example, here in the state of California, have helped to bankrupt us so that we are beginning to lose our educational system and our public health care system and practically every other public institution that we have. And so the people who are in charge of governing the states are beginning to look around them and say, hey, this just isn't working. We're going broke, and the problems are not going away. So let's look for alternatives.
Elliot Curry, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Elliot Curry's book is called Reckoning, Drugs, the Cities, and the American Future. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. Over the weekend, former tennis champion Arthur Ashe died of complications from the AIDS virus. He was the first black man to make it to the top of the tennis world, but he was more than a tennis star. Ashe was national chairman for the American Heart Association after a heart attack ended his playing career. He wrote several books, and last year he created a foundation for AIDS research and education. Coming up, we remember Arthur Ashe with an excerpt from a 1989 interview after he'd just written a three-part history of African-American athletes. And rock historian Ed Ward takes us back 20 years to 1973. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In what is described as an effort to streamline Clinton administration efforts to set environmental policy, President Clinton has abolished the White House Office on Environmental Quality and restated his support for legislation that would raise the Environmental Protection Agency to cabinet status. NPR's John Nielsen has more on the story.
The Council on Environmental Quality, or the CEQ, was a powerful advisory group during the Carter administration, but under Presidents Reagan and Bush, its advice was frequently ignored, most recently in favor of advice from the more pro-business Competitiveness Council. When he was in the Senate, Al Gore criticized the way this council was used. Vice President Gore was at Mr. Clinton's side today when the president announced that he was replacing the CEQ with a smaller, less visible Office on Environmental Quality to be headed by Kathleen McGinty, a 29-year-old lawyer and a former Gore aide. At the same time, Clinton restated his support for legislation that would increase the power of Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Carol Browner. Legislation that would make the EPA a cabinet-level agency has been stalled in Congress for years. In Washington, I'm John Nielsen.
A new report from Iran-Contra prosecutor Lawrence Walsh accuses former President Bush of misusing his power when he pardoned former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger. In a report to Congress, Walsh said a Weinberger trial would have exposed new evidence of Reagan administration efforts to hide details of the Iran-Contra scandal from the public and from Congress. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports.
Weinberger was accused of lying to Congress and trying to conceal notes he had taken about key meetings. He was pardoned last Christmas Eve, along with five other Reagan administration officials, before he ever went to trial. The report portrays a White House concerned about political damage to former President Reagan, even the possibility of impeachment. According to the report, White House officials tried to rearrange the public record to protect their boss. The report says Weinberger's notes document some of these efforts to obscure Reagan's role. It also charges that former President Bush misused his power when he pardoned Weinberger, especially because President Bush was ruling on a case in which he himself was involved. The report drew swift and angry responses from some leading Republicans. Robert Dole called it a last-ditch effort to justify a six-year political crusade by a frustrated prosecutor. This is Anthony Brooks in Washington.
In Somalia, U.S. troops detained more than 30 people, including a Klan leader, after finding a supply of weapons. Among the seized weapons were a rocket launcher and machine guns. All those detained were released after questioning. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 4 points to close at 3,437.54 on volume of some 240 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. According to UN diplomats in New York, the new administration appears to have said no for now to the use of military force in Bosnia. Under consideration are said to be more sanctions against Belgrade and changes in a UN-sponsored plan to divide the nation into 10 separate provinces. Yugoslav officials say that they are in support of the UN plan now under consideration at meetings in New York. However, there has been no UN Security Council action, and none is expected until a move by Washington. Although he's been trying to get the attention of the country and the news media back on the state of the U.S. economy, President Clinton has been caught in the continuing fallout from the Judge Kemba Wood controversy. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president denied today that he was holding female and male appointees to a different standard. On Friday, Kemba Wood, President Clinton's top choice for attorney general, withdrew from consideration, saying that she had hired an illegal immigrant as a babysitter. But that was before a 1986 law making it illegal to hire such workers was passed. Unlike Zoe Baird, whose nomination was scuttled because she had violated the law when she hired illegal immigrants, Wood had paid all Social Security taxes for her babysitter. Today, women's groups furiously pointed to the example of Commerce Secretary Ron Brown, who acknowledged failing to pay Social Security taxes for his housekeeper until after the Zoe Baird story broke. Today, White House officials said the attorney general had to be held to a special standard, but that all cabinet-level officials and senior White House staff have been notified that they're expected to comply fully with the law. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Clinton has proposed a 7-month extension in emergency jobless benefits. If the move is approved by Congress, it would extend benefits to October 2nd. The program is now set to run out March 6th. Under the plan, jobless workers who have used up their regular benefits get an extra 20 to 26 weeks of benefits. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Former tennis champion Arthur Ashe died this past weekend. He was the first African-American man to win the U.S. Open and Wimbledon. But he was also known around the world for his stance on political issues and for the time that he spent in public service. Ashe began competing in tennis in the 1950s, when the courts in his home state of Virginia were still segregated, and the world of professional tennis was, for all practical purposes, a white world. After winning major tournaments around the world, his playing career ended at the age of 36 in 1980 after a heart attack and quadruple bypass surgery. He served as the national campaign chairman of the American Heart Association. Then, in 1988, he was diagnosed with the AIDS virus, and last year, after he went public with his condition, created a foundation for AIDS research and education. Terry Gross spoke with Arthur Ashe in 1989, after he had just written a 3-part history on African-American athletes. He said that although he grew up believing that lots of jobs were off-limits to blacks, the world of sports was beginning to change.
Well, when I became 10, 11, 12 years old, we're talking about the early to mid-50s now, the color line had been broken in the major team sports. There was already a broken line of sorts in boxing and track, but it had not been broken until that period between 1946 and 1950 in basketball, football, baseball, tennis, golf, bowling, and some others. And so I was a sports nut as a child and able to follow the exploits of a Jackie Robinson or Althea Gibson. And in that respect, I was quite fortunate. But not knowing that, had I been born just 2 or 3 years earlier, that would not have been the case.
How did tennis become your sport?
I was always a very good little athlete. I was fast and I was quick, but I was not very big.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not going to play football. I wasn't tall enough to really do that well in basketball. I learned how to swim at a very early age, but was not that interested. Soccer was no longer, was not popular yet. And I also played tennis, I think, because it was not a team sport. It was just me by myself out there alone. And I also, in addition, believe that I gravitated towards sports and books as a way to get over the death of my mother, which occurred when I was just 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I think books and sports may have saved me from going slightly nuts.
You've pointed out that when you were coming of age, blacks really had no identification with the sport of tennis. And I was wondering if that was ever an obstacle to your appreciation of the sport.
Not really. I knew who the black sports heroes were in the field of tennis. People like Jimmy McDaniel. Of course, we were all aware of Althea Gibson and very proud of her for having blazed the trail. And I knew some of the other very good black players. But all of us knew that We wanted to play at Forest Hills. I wanted to play in the Davis Cup. I wanted to play at Wimbledon. And in the late 40s, that was just not possible. But that didn't stop us from wanting to realize our dreams in any event.
Did anyone ever try to discourage you and tell you that there was very little room for black players in the sport?
No. Not discouragement to the extent of saying stop because there's only so high you can go. No. But it was certainly pointed out that there were no, with the exception of Althea, there were no black role models that you could point to that had gone as far as she had gone, especially no men. No men at all. Completely none.
It's funny because it's usually the opposite way, right?
Yes, yes, most sports. Yes, that's exactly right. But and it's still that way today. That is, to the extent that there may be more black participation in the sport, like tennis in the future, I think most of the participation in the next decade or so will be females rather than males.
What was the world of black tennis like when you started to play?
Well, it was a very self-contained world, largely confined to the East Coast cities of Durham, North Carolina, Richmond, Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Montclair, New Jersey, New York City, New Haven, Connecticut, Boston. There were some outposts in Wilberforce, Ohio. Any place in the South that had a black college was a mecca for black tennis. And Kansas City and Los Angeles. And, oh, yes, those Houston and Dallas were meccas, and Prairie View, Texas, because that was the site of a rather large black college, Prairie View A&M. And those were the places where blacks congregated from year to year, and summer to summer, to play and to socialize, meet one another. And that went on from 1916, and it continues until this very day.
Were there tournaments that you wanted to play in that you were barred from because of segregation?
Oh, sure. Oh, yes. I was barred from all official sanctioned events in my home state. In fact, I only played in one sanctioned event in my home state as a junior player in my life. That was when I was 18, and I came back to play in the National Interscholastics, that is the national tournament for high school athletes. That was held in Charlottesville, Virginia, 1961. That's the only integrated or sanctioned event I ever played in my own home state as a junior.
You're listening to a 1989 interview that Terry Gross did with tennis champion Arthur Ashe. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry Gross's interview with Arthur Ashe.
You were the first black to win many of the titles that you won. You were the first black to win the Junior Davis Cup, the first black to get a UCLA tennis scholarship, the first black to win Wimbledon. I think the first also to win...
Black man.
Black man, okay, right.
Yes.
Also the same for the U.S. Open. What were some of the pressures that went along with being the first black or first black man to win some of these titles?
Well, the pressures were more closely associated with certain time periods.
Uh-huh.
I felt enormous pressure in the 60s because that was the decade of the era of the black social revolution. That's when Dr. King started his crusades, and you had your sit-ins and your freedom rides and summer trips to Selma, Alabama, and you had the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act coming into being in 64 and 65. And Malcolm X was in his heyday, and the Vietnam War, and Muhammad Ali refusing to cross the line for induction to the U.S. Army, and Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising their fists at Mexico City at the Olympics. So against the background, the context of the 1960s, I felt enormous pressure to contribute to black social progress. In the 1970s, it all but disappeared. Any pressure one may have felt then, anybody black may have felt, was self-inflicted, self-imposed almost. It just completely disappeared. And now there's very little pressure to do anything. especially be compared with the era of the 1960s.
Do you think that's good or bad?
Well,
Or neither.
I'm sort of ambivalent about it.
Uh-huh.
There's no question I think it helped. No matter who you were or what endeavor your expertise was in, if you were a noted, if you had any degree of fame at all, you were expected to participate in the 1960s. But, and you were even badgered into it almost, in ways of trying to prove that you were blacker than somebody else. You know, your afro was bigger than your dashiki was more African than the next black person's. That just completely disappeared in the 70s. And I can't find it at all in the 80s. And we know the reasons, but it's just sad to see it completely disappear because everybody now seems a bit more self-centered than they were before.
Mm-hmm. So you think some of those pressures that went along with the 60s were somewhat superficial, but on the other hand, you wish things were a little more political today?
Well, not so much superficial as someone like myself and quite a few people being in a position where if you were from the South, you were legally proscribed from doing a lot of things by whites.
Mm-hmm.
And here you were in the 60s being pressured into doing things by blacks who were in so-called leaders, positions of responsibility and influence. And you came to the point where you wanted to ask yourself, well, when do I get a chance to make up my own mind about something?
Uh-huh.
That's the situation I felt most deeply. All my life up until I left school to go to college in California, I had whites telling me what I could and could not do, where I could and could not go. And all of a sudden, in the decade of the 60s, you have your black militants and other black leaders telling me what I should do solely because I'm black. And again, I would like to be able to make that decision for myself if I could once in life. But as far as tennis was concerned, for instance, the one area where I felt this tug both ways was in the issue of dealing with South Africa.
Yeah.
I was told in 1968 that if I wanted to go play in the South African Open, they probably wouldn't let me go because they don't allow blacks to play down there. Now, that had happened to me all my life as a junior in my own hometown, and I was in the position of saying, well, I'll be damned if that'll happen to me as a senior player. And when I wanted to go down there, you run into the opposition by some other blacks who say, you can't go down there because if you do, you'll be lending credence and credibility to that system. But I was just trying to prove a point that, hey, here's a country that said I can't play. And my position was, you either let me play or your tournament doesn't count. One of the two. Take your pick.
Mm-hmm. Athletes really have to be very single-minded to develop their abilities. And I'm wondering if it was hard for you to figure out how to divide your energies between civil rights actions that you participated in or speaking out on behalf of certain issues and devoting your time to your sport.
Very difficult, very difficult. I got in trouble once when I was stationed at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. I was an officer there and second lieutenant, and I made a speech in a black church in Washington that the Army thought was a bit too political. It was covered in the Washington Post, and I was called into the superintendent's office and told, in no uncertain terms, that if you do that again, you're going to be grounded, meaning we wouldn't be allowed to go out to play Davis Cup or whatever. Yet, you felt almost duty-bound to say something. Things were at such a fever pitch in 1968. That was the year, of course, when Dr. King was assassinated. That's when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. That's when Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists. And looking back on it, I don't regret it at all, even though I know Army regulations forbid anybody in the Army from engaging in political activity. But you just felt almost compelled to say something.
That was Arthur Ashe speaking with Terry Gross back in 1989. Arthur Ashe died this past weekend. He was 49. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about the show today. Noah, what stories will you be sharing with us?
Hi, Marty. Tony Brooks reports on the release of a report by Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh, saying that there would have been testimony at a trial of former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger that would have shown President Reagan knew about arms sales to Iran. President Bush, of course, pardoned Mr. Weinberger, and that trial was canceled. Joyce Davis reports from the Sudan, beginning a series of stories about women in the Islamic world. In the Sudan, women are allowed to vote and serve in the parliament, and aspects of Sudanese life are held up as models for the rest of the world of Islam. And Tom Manhoff on the opera The Death of Klinghoffer.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last week, our rock historian Ed Ward looked back at where rock music was 30 and 40 years ago, just before the Beatles and Elvis revolutionized the scene. Well, 1973 in rock was anything but revolutionary. Ed Ward says he didn't think he had many fond memories of the year until recently.
I used to joke that I couldn't remember several years in the 70s at all, 1973 and 74 chief among them. But when I sat down with a list of 1973's top records, I realized that I did in fact remember the year better than I'd let on, and with more affection than I'd thought. It's not nostalgia, though. It's just that 1973 was a year when lines were being drawn, and I'd soon find myself on the wrong side of nearly all of them. It was a year just before FM radio got all but unlistenable, and a year when AM radio still had its occasional gem. Very superstitious, writings on the wall. Very superstitious, letters about to fall. 13-month-old. Stevie Wonder, for instance, had the best year of his life with four top 10 singles, which ranged from the clavinet-driven light funk of Superstition to a straight-ahead pop song that could have come from any era of pop music. You are the sunshine of my life. That's why I'll always be around. You are the Elton John was never a favorite of mine, but again, he was capable of great pop moments in 1973.
When are you gonna come down? When are you going to land? I should have stayed on the phone. I should have listened to my own mind.
Britain, in fact, still held a lot of clout on the airwaves, and all four Beatles had top 10 records in 1973, three of them number ones. One of them was Ringo's, believe it or not.
Oh,
John Lennon's Mind Games that didn't make it to the top, by the way. If there's a common thread that runs through 1973's top records, it's production. Recording technology had expanded like never before. Everybody, from Stevie Wonder to Elton John's producer Gus Dudgeon to Arif Mardin, who produced another number one this year, Roberta Flack's Killing Me Softly with his song, and would soon guide the Bee Gees to disco heaven, was flexing those studio muscles. All of which meant that the guitar-based drum sound the Beatles had ushered in a decade ago was relegated to the FM side of the spectrum, where DJs with superior attitudes played bands like Led Zeppelin, The who single-handedly bankrupted the rock opera this year with Quadrophenia, Yes, with two albums, Yes Songs and Tales of Topographic Oceans, Jethro Tull, and Queen, who debuted this year. In retrospect, though, this stuff seems as turgid and overproduced as anything on AM. And to be fair, some of it was even good. Roxy Music, along with David Bowie, who was just starting his rise to fame, were going to prove to be influential long after a lot of the FM noise of 1973 was long gone. It was all British, you'll notice. America was still suffering from an inferiority complex, and it wouldn't be until next year that bands like Kiss would raise the nation from its mellow doldrums. Meanwhile, the U.S. was putting out great black music, even though the Motown empire was falling apart and Stax was a dead issue. Much of it came from Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff and their Philadelphia studios, which were making great records by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes and the OJs. No, things in 1973 weren't as bad as I remembered. On the other hand, looking at the lists of hits for the years to come, I can see that it got a lot worse before it got better.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Audrey Vablaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Marty Moskowain.
So he's leaving the light. He's come to know. Ooh.
He said he's going.
He said he's going back to find.
Going back to find.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. What's left of his world? The world he left behind. Not so long.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the man they call the Carl Sagan of bioethics. We talk with medical ethicist Arthur Kaplan. His new book is If I Were a Rich Man, Could I Buy a Pancreas? I'm Marty Moskowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.